Earlier this week, victims of sexual abuse by former team doctor Larry Nassar reached a $380 million settlement with USA Gymnastics and the U.S. Olympic and Paralympic Committee. Here's former gymnast Rachel Den Hollander, who was the first victim to come forward publicly with allegations against Nassar, talking to the BBC.
I think it's important to recognize what it really took to get here. It took over 500 women. It took 5 years. It took dozens of survivors willing to go through the court process in Michigan and become victims whose crimes were charged. It took so much incredible effort and sacrifice of so many people. And I think one of the lessons that we have to learn is, A, what it takes to get here, but also start asking the question, how do we create a system of justice where it doesn't require Olympians and over 500 survivors to come forward to reach this? Because what happens to the survivors who don't have anyone? If it was this uphill of a battle for Nassar survivors and USAG survivors, what does it look like for sexual abuse survivors who don't have anyone? And how do we start creating justice for that?
We've talked about the charges against Nassar in the past on the show. Now we're looking to the future and how to create sports programs with a system of safety, accountability, and transparency so we hopefully don't end up here again. You can join in at 800-642-1234. What's your reaction been to the settlement with victims of Larry Nassar? Do you have questions about how sports organizations are set up currently to deal with allegations of misconduct or assault? If you work in an athletic program at any level, youth through college or pro, what do you like, what do you not like about how your organization handles these concerns? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas@WPR.org. B. David Ridpath is Associate Professor of Sports Business at Ohio University. He's an expert in a variety of related issues, including sports governance, NCAA rules and compliance, and risk management. He's author of the book Alternative Models of Sports Development in America, Solutions to a Crisis in Education and Public Health. Dave, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Appreciate being on. Thanks so much.
So we had this settlement. There's the dollar amount, but another part of the settlement wasn't monetary. It's a requirement that at least one abuse survivor have a seat on the board of directors for USA Gymnastics. What's your reaction to that part of it, bringing in somebody who's been through all of this into the management of the organization?
Well, I think one of the biggest things we can do in sports governance to help, you know, better protect the athletes, but I also think to run sports organizations better, that it is important to have representation on all committees at all levels of governance, and all sports organizations have representation of the athletes. And this goes back, Rob, to the Amateur Sports Act in the 70s, of where when the USOC was created, one of the main emphasis of that overhaul of amateur sports in America was that the committees of the USOC would have at least 20% athlete representation. Now, I'm not here to say that it's perfect, but it is very important that, essentially like anything else, you can go to labor unions, you can go to any type of governance in any other aspect. It is important to have, whether you could call it workers, athlete, labor, whatever you want, it is important to have their representation and their voice within the governance structure. That better protects the athlete.
Now, it seems like we've seen this kind of story again and again. Women's gymnastics, the biggest example. We've seen, high-profile football programs, Penn State and others. Women's pro soccer. Just again and again, sport after sport, some kind of abuse or harassment, and then a lack of response from the organization when those things are brought up internally. What do you think needs to change so that instead of waiting years and years, at the first sign, the first hint of a problem, better action is taken?
Well, I do agree. I mean, I think, we have this issue in sports that has permeated, literally almost since its inception, that we want to protect what is important to us. We want to protect, what we love. We want to protect the competitive aspect, the branding of it, whatever you want to talk about it. And oftentimes the bad news conflicts with what we really want to put forth in the public. And so I do think that you have leaders, not at all times, but many times in the situation, certainly in the Nassar situation, that were more concerned with protecting themselves and protecting the brand rather than getting to the bottom of what was happening. And that's where, again, it comes to obviously leadership, good moral and ethical leadership of people who are willing to do the right thing and who have the backbone to do the right thing, even in the face of extreme pressure. You know, my background is college athletics. People do not want to hear about bad things in their college athletics program. They only want to win. They want to be entertained. And certainly with the case of USA Gymnastics, you know, they want to protect that persona. But if you have athletes in the governance structure, they are more likely to go out and protect their own. They're more likely to come out and say, look, you have a place to go to. You have representation. You have somebody who's going to stand up for you. And really in the old governance structure, that wasn't there. There was no place for an Allie Raceman to go when, you know, Bella Caroli had total power, or somebody like Larry Nassar was protected by the gymnastics coach or the athletic director. You give the athletes the access and the voice and the ability to have input on their day-to-day lives and what affects them, certainly athletically and personally, I do believe that this can change.
You mentioned protecting what we value in an athletic organization, and that maybe that's a fundamental thing we need to rethink. Is the thing we value the winning record in the bowl game appearances or the gold medals at the Olympics and other world competitions, or is the valuable thing resource we ought to protect the athletes themselves?
Well, you'd like to think that we would want to protect the athletes themselves and do the right thing. I've often said, and this is kind of a simple way of looking at it, but sports makes rational people irrational. Look, I'm a fan. I have my favorite teams. I love to see my team win. But working in the industry, I don't think that there's a more bottom line industry in the world. You either win or you don't. And if you don't win, it's usually problematic in some way. You could even look at Urban Meyer today. If Urban Meyer was 13-2 and not 2-13, he wouldn't have been fired today, regardless of all the situations surrounding him. And that's sad when you think about this. What I tell my classes, Rob, is this, is that you can't do something in sports or not do something in sports that you would do in your normal walk of life. So the standard you walk by is the standard you accept. But because winning is the bottom line, and you're not successful if you don't win, and you're going to try to do everything, and I'm saying this more generally, but people often are going to try to get the edge, sadly, by any means necessary. Oftentimes it is the athlete that is the exploited one, while many others get the glory and get rich.
Talking to Dave Ridpath from Ohio University in Athens, associate professor there of sports business, looking at issues of how we set up athletic organizations, especially amateur ones, college, Olympic, World Cup, especially after the settlement now in the gymnastics abuse case. You could join in at 800-642-1234. Have you been part of an organization like this, a college athletics program, say? What worked? What didn't? Were there things you needed to see changed? Are our priorities wrong? Do we focus too much on the record, the gold medals, the outcomes, not enough on the development of the athletes? 800-642-1234 and their well-being. 800-642-1234 or email ideas@WPR.org. Dave, you've mentioned the idea a couple times of, you know, athletics being represented in the management of their organization. Can you point toward an organization or two that you think is doing it right, that is implementing this and it's making a difference?
Well, I do think it maybe some people would disagree. And you know, look, I'm a child of the 60s and 70s, and I certainly liked it when you could say in professional sports that you'd have the same team for 10 or 12 years. But certainly having the labor movement in professional sports and having the players unions has better protected the players, right? They've been able to stand up against, you know, against bullying owners and other things like that. So you have to point to that as an example of the athletes have a voice, and things cannot be decided without the athletes having an equal place at the table. And that's really where, you know, in the Olympics, going back to the Amateur Sports Act, in the overall governance structure, we certainly have athlete representation within the USOC, but certainly the individual athlete was not as empowered within the national governing bodies and the individual sports as they should be. And at least having that place that they know they can go to, that, you know, hey, this is a problem. Even if somebody says this is a legitimate medical procedure, I need to talk to somebody about this and to have that type of outlet. And so at least, you know, you have player representation in professional sports. And I do believe a model like that is a similar one that could work in other sports governance situations.
a college athletes union of sorts?
Absolutely. And I've long advocated that you can have a college athletes union, a non-wage based, if you will, college athletes union that could actually be representative of all college athletes and negotiate everything other than a wage and benefits, because the pay to play issue, although I certainly believe that college athletes are employees and they certainly have a legitimate claim to being paid as employees because we treat them as employees, but we say they're students, and you can't say they're students and treat as employees. You can't have it both ways. But you can certainly have a non-wage type union that can negotiate everything else, healthcare. Even with name, image, and likeness and all the things we've heard the past couple of days, what I've told my friends in the NCAA structure is you need to negotiate directly with the athletes. If you don't want them to do pornography or alcohol advertisements, you collectively negotiate that with them so it's agreed upon by all parties. Don't try to mandate that to them, or even have an outside entity like the government or different states regulate that. If you have a bargaining agreement, and again, it doesn't have to be pay to play. If you have a bargaining agreement like that, you really give the athletes a voice and they have input on this decision-making. And right now in college sports, the athletes have absolutely zero input on the decisions that are made for them.
We're talking to Dave Ridpath, Associate Professor of Sports Business at Ohio University. Talk about ways that sports organizations could reform to stamp out, prevent assaults and cover-ups like we've seen come to light from USA Gymnastics and many other organizations in the sports world. And you can join in at 800-642-1234. With large sports organizations, who do you want to see held accountable for abuse on their watch? Are there reforms you'd like to see at, say, major university sports programs, national teams, Olympic and Paralympic committee? Would you like to rebuild them from the ground up? Do you have experience in these kinds of organizations yourself? What do you think? Call 800-642-1234. What do you think of this idea of a college athletes union? Not for wages, but to talk about everything else. 800-642-1234 is the number. That's 800-642-1234. You can also email ideas@WPR.org. We'll continue the conversation, maybe hear from you, coming up on Central Time. It's Central Time. I'm Rob Verrett. Right now we're picking up our talk about reforming or reimagining sports organizations to be safer, more accountable, and to better protect athletes, especially, say, student athletes or young athletes in national programs. Dave Ridpath is Associate Professor of Sports Business at Ohio University. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Do you feel like big name coaches have too much power in athletic organizations? Are there changes you'd like to see maybe in an organization you've been part of? 800-642-1234 is the number. That's 800-642-1234, or email ideas@WPR.org. Dave, some sports leaders, I'm thinking mainly college football coaches, some gymnastics coaches, others, there's almost like a cult status around them. Do you think that the balance of power swings sometimes too strongly to those rock star figures in the sports world?
Well, it really does. And speaking in, you know, certainly my world of college sports, you know, to me, it's completely backward that a coach is the highest paid employee in, I think, 43 or 44 of the states, whether it's a college basketball coach or a college football coach. That really is a problem with our society of what we value. And a lot of people will come out and say that, you know, that, well, that's the market value of the coaches. Well, it's really not. When you don't pay the labor, that is an artificial market that has been essentially inflated in our win at all cost culture. You have to win or you don't. And I think we crossed the $100 million barrier a couple weeks ago of coaches that are being paid not to coach. This is in a higher education environment. This is absolutely ridiculous. And that's why a group that I'm a part of, the Drake Group, named after Drake University, where we had our first meeting over 20 years ago, is we are petitioning Congress for a very limited antitrust exemption to control out of control costs in intercollegiate athletics, because there is so much of it that is simply not needed. It's a race to the top. It's an arms race, essentially. And specifically with salaries, there's a power dynamic there. If you have a president that's only making $1 million and you have a football coach whose one is winning, he or she is winning, and is making $5 million, who's going to have the de facto power on that campus? And we certainly saw that with Joe Paterno. We've seen that at Michigan State. And so in my view, that just even the pay structure and having a limited antitrust exemption and essentially say that coaches cannot get paid more, $1, have to be paid $1 less than the highest paid person on that campus. And you take Wisconsin-Madison, there's some pretty highly paid people on that campus, whether it's the president, might be a research scholar who brought in some grant money. Those coaches are still going to get paid quite handsomely. We do not need to be paying college coaches $10 million a year, because that sets the whole leadership and governance structure on its head. And it puts those coaches in many positions where they can get away with anything, especially if they're winning. And that needs to change.
I know you have concerns, I think, about just how closely interwoven amateur athletics and colleges are. Is it time to divorce education from sports?
I wouldn't say so much of a divorce, Rob, as maybe a reimagining. It is important for your listeners to know, if they don't know this, but we are the only country in the world that has a significant portion of all athletic development, whether at the elite or mass participation level, grounded in the education system. Now, on paper, it sounds very good. Hey, you play a sport, you're going to school, and certainly from a college perspective, hey, college is expensive. Here's a way that you can offset some costs by playing a sport. It's very counterintuitive, as a matter of fact, and sometimes being the only country in the world that does something maybe isn't the smartest thing to do. We need in America, and this is what I talk about in my book that I know you're going to mention, my book Alternative Models, is we need other options of elite sport development outside the education space. Because it is our primary development system, not only for our international and national teams, and the fact that educationally based sports, specifically college athletics, is so commercially driven, it has made our whole system throughout more of a race to the top. And school-based sports are supposed to be about sound mind and body and participation and exposure to sports. We need to have, like Europe does, models outside the education system where those elite athletes who are elite, and they should, and we should as a country, provide those options to train, get an education, and go as far as they can in their sport, but do that outside the education system. Because we're putting so much emphasis on football and basketball, we're losing sports in the system we have right now. And also, we are losing the ability for kids to be able to participate at all levels because we're focusing on winning, as most of your listeners know, even at the lowest youth sports levels, that it does have a very huge public health impact. And I know that's kind of a large mouthful, what I said there, but it isn't eliminating and divorcing completely, but we do need to reimagine the elite sport and commercialized sport connection to our education system.
Let's bring on a caller now. Mike is with us in Oconomowoc. Mike, hi.
Hi. I'm just curious, because when I hear these conversations about this, given that sports has got to be the number one draw of money to any campus, and I just moved here from North Carolina not too long ago, on Duke and UNC Chapel Hill. I mean, if they didn't have basketball, say, as draw, would they even get the amount of grants and research grants and student population or draw for the highest level of students into those schools without that kind of background and backbone of a great sports arena for them?
I gotcha, Mike. We don't have too much time left, but his point, Dave, these sports programs can be big advertisements to bring in students, research money, and more.
It's a fair question. I will tell you, we're talking about research, has not really shown that these universities having a major sports program has led to, research grants. In fact, some of our, I would say maybe less successful programs, their schools have massive research grants. The attachment to attendance and marketing and those types of things, again, is very nebulous. I always say this, Duke and North Carolina or Wisconsin-Madison, they would exist without the football program and they would, or athletic program, and they would be just fine. I mean, we look at some of these research grants that are brought in, they're in the billions of dollars, and it eclipses what athletics bring in. I do think it is, there's a lot of myth that to be a great university, you have to have a great athletic program or even have an athletic program. My point is, Rob, is that you can still have intercollegiate athletics. If Duke and North Carolina, it almost doesn't matter who plays, people are going to show up to watch. What I'm saying is that the elite athlete and the main pathway to the NBA, the NFL, and to our national teams should not be only through the educational system. And right now, that is the pathway about 85% of the time. And that's what we need to change. Sports can still exist on campus, but it doesn't need to exist at the level it is. And North Carolina and Duke, you know, North Carolina was a university before they ever had a football and basketball team. They will exist just fine.
Very briefly, just in our last few moments, Dave, do you see sports organizations, especially in college, rethinking their systems to improve them?
You know, I hope so. I do think that a lot of this is going to be driven. I think, you know, ultimately we might see, not that the NCAA wants to do it, but we might see college athletes being paid. And I do think that many schools might have to reimagine what they're doing. And I think that's okay. Maybe only some schools can actually afford to pay college athletes a salary or continue on the path they're going on now. And that's okay. And maybe the other schools go to more of an academic model. But I also believe as changes are going on that other systems are going to manifest themselves. And we need to, as a country, address, you know, more access at all levels, mass participation and recreation to help our public health aspect. According to Johns Hopkins, if we simply had kids right now between under the age of 18, active another 90 minutes per week, that we would save over 30 years, close to $1 trillion in medical costs. I mean,
and we'll leave it there. And I hope to talk to you about that again sometime. Dave Ridpath has been with us, author of the book Alternative Models of Sports Development. He's at Ohio University. Joined us for a look at rethinking the way amateur athletics are organized.